The following is a quarantine recording presented to you in Around Sound.
It was recorded with whatever was lying around.
Lady don't take no shit, insist on respect the sister, walk around like a womanish. She won't speak less of something worse saying, don't play. The girl take herself so seriously. People stare curiously. She got a natural way, her hips sway furiously. Yeah, luxuriously. Carries herself like the cutest, most prettiest thing you've seen this side of the bay.
Hey! This is Lady Don't Take No, your weekly roundup of all of the real and none of the fake. I'm your host, Alicia Garza. This show is pro-Black, pro-queer, proudly feminist, and pro-do-what-you-like. Every week, you're going to get the best of what goes on in my head, what we loving on and what we hating on, what we might be and what we ain't going to do, politics, pop culture, an ongoing culture war that is attacking everything we fought so hard for. We cover it all. We are recording from Oakland, California, the center of the known universe, where we are dealing with Rona and Reconstruction. It's a challenging time. It's a changing time. It's a time of transformation. It's all the things all the time nowadays, but we are going to help you understand the dynamics of this time every single week. So be sure to tune in, tell a friend, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. We do it for the culture, so the pod is free 99, because we know that with a country in chaos, the least we could do is keep you from putting your money anywhere else than where it's needed.
All the clerks want to offer you help. All the folks compliment you stoutly. A little children want to jump in your lap. Girl, I want to do that myself.
Our guest this week is an author and a teacher who specializes in the study of Black women's intellectual history, hip-hop generation feminism, and race and gender representation in popular culture. Her work and words have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, TheRoot.com, and countless other outlets. Her critically acclaimed book, Beyond Respectability, The Intellectual Thought of Race Women, is required reading, and it's brilliant. And I love, love, love Eloquent Rage. So I don't have to tell you who I'm talking to. I'm so honored to have her on the show today. Please welcome to the pod, Dr. Brittany Cooper. What's going on, Dr. Cooper?
Hey, Alicia.
How you be? I'm so happy to have you today.
Yeah, I'm hype. I'm glad to be here. I'm hanging in there. We're trying to make our way to the other side of this Rona, doing our best.
Listen. Well, speaking of the Rona, you know, we're in this weird transition period, right? Where it's like, I read somewhere that we are 50% vaccinated as a country. And I still haven't made up my mind as to whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. But nonetheless, I got to ask you, what has your quarantine life been like? Have you developed any unique habits live and direct from Miss Rona?
What has quarantine been like? I mean, I pretty much spent it by myself because that's kind of how I'm living. So I did all the things. I learned how to make sourdough, taught myself how to do that, ended up with some really cool loaves. I'm on my second year of trying to now have a garden. Uh-huh. Last year, it was pretty much a bust. But this year, I learned some lessons and basically went and got the plants when they were almost ready to bloom. And that's what I'm doing. And I also am learning the wonders my mother and I both have in our respective homes and little arrow garden where we're growing lettuce and cherry tomatoes. So those are probably the new pandemic habits that I developed because it became a sort of like, I grew up in the rural South, deep South. And I was like, why are you living like this without any like skills of growing things? And so I was like, so if some shit pop off, then I'll have flour and water and I can make bread and I'll know how to grow some plants and, you know, we'll be all right.
What are some new pandemic skills that you've developed? I mean, it feels like we're heading into the apocalypse. This isn't actually a temporary thing. So I got to know what you bring into the table.
Yeah, I mean, right. Because I do want to be, when the revolution comes, I do want to be able to go. I don't want to be left behind. You know, part of the thing I think I did a lot of this year was just digging in around community building, around I'm the like check in with your friends, have the conversations, figure out how we're going to process all the emotions. That's actually really core to me. I believe very much in like, what does it mean to do your own emotional work so that we're not raggedy to each other? And this was a year that really required that. But I also think that one of the things I learned was to figure out how to just sit the hell down when shit was hard, like to sit in feelings, discomfort, loneliness, the sort of ache of like grief and loss, and to not, I mean, this time we couldn't cope by running away, piling on work, doing, you know, it just was a like, there were days, the thing that happens when you're in a house by yourself for a year is that you have to confront all the shit that you don't like about yourself or that you're not happy with about yourself, right?
You better and tell the whole fucking truth.
And it's hard, you know, it's very hard. And learning to like sit with it often for, and not know when the relief is going to come and then to sort of try to figure out what it looks like to make it to the other side of that. That's what I did a lot of this year, was really trying to think about who do I want to be in the world and who do I want to be after this? And what are the things that I'm really good at and what are the things that I suck at?
That is actually incredibly profound in so many ways. And I have so many things I want to talk to you about. So look, I first discovered you and your brilliance through the Crunk Feminist Collective in 2013. And in fact, I remember I was out knocking doors and I was taking a little break because, you know, talking to people is exhausting. And I was scrolling through an article that you had written, a blog that you had posted, and I was cackling. I said, who is this? She's funny. This was a mere few months before I actually met you in person on the Black Lives Matter Freedom Ride. Now, what I love about the Crunk Feminist Collective is how it brings together the ratchet and the feminist just like completely seamlessly. So can you talk with us a little bit more for the people who are listening who may not have yet encountered the Crunk Feminist Collective? Tell us more about it and tell us what we can expect from CFC moving forward.
Yeah, look, the Crunk Feminists are my girls. We started an early iteration when we were in Atlanta in grad school, some of us in the early 2000s. And basically, we were going to the club and talking shit on the weekends and then doing these graduate seminars together. And then we would throw these wild parties to cope with all the foolishness, racism, and sexism that happened in the grad seminars. And we were like, well, we're crunk and we're feminist. So why can't we like smash them together? Because we were also getting all of that rhetoric about how you couldn't, you know, you couldn't listen to booty shake music. You couldn't listen to Southern hip hop and also want to dismantle the patriarchy. And we were like, but who wants to go to a party where everything is super woke, right? I mean, you need something.
Correct. Like, we can't listen to Sweet Honey in the Rock all the goddamn time. We need something else.
That thing, right? So it was our way of sort of claiming our legacy. And so years later, we sort of relaunched it when feminists were really launching blogs. And we built this amazing community of thinkers and writers. And we are a collective. We are seven strong. We are activists, organizers, professors, Hollywood directors, all of the things. This is our new iteration. One of the things we launched this spring is The Remix, which is our weekly newsletter. Because we were like, look, when we first started, we were very much like responding to the news cycle and responding with these crunk perspectives, but it became unsustainable because we grown now, we got kids now and tenure now, careers, you know? And so we're literally trying to think with people in this iteration of the CFC. When we started and we was the young hot chicks in the club, we were thinking about how could you be about that and still want to take down patriarchy? Now we're like middle aged and our knees hurt and we're like, do it, Meg. No, do it, don't. Do it, all you youngsters that can twerk. We love that. But what does it mean to actually try to live out these politics as really fully grown women who've been around the block for a bit? And look, in the end, the CFC for me is my argument about how I think revolution occurs. It's our collective argument, which is that, you know, it's that old adage, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. There's all this competition in this month. We are in like, you know, unprecedented Black excellence. Everybody want their thing. And the thing that I have learned, one of the key ways we have to resist the scarcity narrative of white supremacy, patriarchy, and capitalism in particular, is this idea that there can only be one great one. My whole crew bad. Everybody bad. Everybody can write. Everybody's thoughtful and insightful. People are brilliant and multi-talented. And the thing that helps you when you stay up close with really brilliant people is it keeps you humble. Mm-hmm. It reminds you that what you have to bring is amazing. But the weight of the world does not rest on your own brilliance, but that's rather right. on our ability to shine together. And I'm like committed to that, you know, because people come up and they want to give you opportunities that are just for you. And it's like, we have had to learn with each other that we don't want the loneliness that attends to that, even though there's some, you know, there's some awards that come with it, but the loneliness of it is not a win.
Ooh.
And Ooh. So we're like, look, we go together. We have each other's back. And and I, you know, I wish that more folks understood the power of crew. And the other big lesson I think we learn with each other at CFC, you know, it's actually a little bit, you know this, you gotta know this, Alicia. Like sometimes we're more just with the people we don't know than with the people that we do know.
You better tell the truth.
You know, like we externalize our movement stuff, yeah. right? But then yeah. internally, like stuff be hard, you know, like just because we're all building work together in collective is hard. And we decided, you know, after a schism in the CFC some years ago, which we wrote about and tried to handle lovingly on our blog, we decided that we cared more about our relationship with each other than the work we produced in the world. And that what we had to do first was to treat each other well. And then from there, we could sort of build out to do things for other people. And I think it has served us well. So
I really love that y'all did that work. And I wish we would do that work.
In our movements.
Yeah, I'm all in my feels about that these days. And maybe it's just the full moon and the lunar eclipse and Mercury coming.
Yeah, the astrology.
You know, retrograde and all the things. But, you know, we got more smoke for people who are not our damn enemies.
Come on.
Then we got smoke for the people who are literally trying to kill us. Like literally, like they out here unabashed, like, oh no, I'm gonna fuck you up. Yeah. And we out here like, okay, but that's not the real problem. The real problem is some small ass shit that doesn't fucking matter. But let me not go ahead and editorialize. This is your interview, not mine.
No, I'm with you. We're hard on the people who try. We let, you know, it's like, this is my like soapbox about why everybody is mad. It's like everybody mad at the woke kids. Look, I always get into trouble with this, I'm going to go ahead and say, how we matter, like legit, if patriarchy is a real system, like why people ain't got smoke for these white men that's out here blowing up the universe? Come on. Like, no. I am not trying to let white women off the hook. I mean, I have written real, like ain't white people, look, I mean, white people haven't really even visited my house, like, since I've been a grown person, to be clear, okay? Like, I have some clear boundaries about what kind of work I'm going to try to do in the world and all that stuff, but legit, I'm like, y'all be having all the smoke for the people in the streets, the folks trying to do the work, the teachers who try, y'all hate them because they don't get it right, and the folks who are doing all the damage, just keep skating on by, you know, like as though they're not worthy of analysis, focus, attention, all of the things. And it really frustrates me.
It's very frustrating. And, you know, I wish I have this adage of my own, which is I don't care how much I like somebody. If they always got smoke for somebody, I don't really fuck with them because I know I'm next. I'm like, no, you've stopped being insightful and, you know, all those things. Now I just think you messy.
That's right.
And if you're messy out here in these streets, honey, you're going to be messy in my house. And that's not allowed. Your book, Eloquent Rage, is fantastic. It's such a powerful read. And I was honored to be able to blurb the book. And I remember reading it. I was at Hedgebrook and I was supposed to be writing my own damn book. But I was like, but I really want to read this one. And so I read it. literally in less than a day. I could not put it down. It was excellent. You is smart, and you is also an excellent, engaging writer. In it, you're really weaving this narrative that helps the reader better understand what Black women in particular are navigating on a daily basis, what the fuck we're so mad about, why being mad is actually important in the process of social change, yeah, how it shapes us, but also how we're shaping the world around us. Tell me what inspired you to write this book, because I've been seeing, and I have seen lots of subsequent iterations of this theory, but I like that yours is really rooted and grounded in Black women. So did this book require a different process of writing it than your other books did?
Oh yeah, look, totally different. I mean, I think I like cried every day writing this book because it's so, you know, it's so deeply emotional and personal. And I was trying to say, like, I'm not here for a politics that's just about the systemic analysis. If we can't figure out how to tell people part, like, the reason why your love life look crazy, girl, is not just because, like, you're messed up or something. Yeah. It's because there's a world that conspires against Black love in all its forms, queer Black love, straight Black love, all the Black love, right? I really wanted to think, you know, sort of come into, like, how are we living the intimate consequences of these intersections? And do we see that so much of the grief we carry is structurally induced? And so writing it was super heavy. You know, I talk very much about my own personal story. It's the first time that I'd really said a lot publicly about my own dad and, you know, and even writing about my own family and realizing how much of my life had been shaped by violence, by brutal violence, was kind of staggering. But I wrote this book because here's the thing that was interesting when Eloquent was coming out, when I was selling it and, you know, getting the book deal for it and then, you know, publishing it, the sort of going narrative was that white women buy books and make them bestsellers. It's like the publishing industry had forgotten that Black women been read, right? And I was like, nah, I think that we can tell a story about feminism and politics in a contemporary moment with Black women at the center. That's not this explainer to white people about how things work, but is like talking about Black women and girls' stories unapologetically, and that it will have a broad readership. And the thing I think I'm most proud of with this book is that I have proved that that is true, that we can put Black women at the center of a story about American politics, because everybody's fine when three Black women are leading the revolution for social change, and everybody's fine when Stacey Abrams is, you know, saving us from voter suppression, right? But then people, you know, so everybody's all trust Black women, listen to Black women, Black women have vision. And then when it comes time to tell the story, then they want it to be about them, their experience, and how you can help them to understand. And I was like, I want a Black girl to pick up this book on her nightstand and feel like a homegirl is sitting down talking to her saying, yes, she ain't crazy. Like, yes, nah, like I yes, felt that, like we right here. And that is what I wanted to achieve on the page, because I'm like, who talks to Black women and tells us that we matter and that our experiences are central to, you know, challenging American empire, and that's always been true, but also that we deserve to be loved, or that sometimes it's hard to be friends with other sisters, right? Because all the trauma show up and fuck things up, or
that's right,
you know, or I wanted that like Black girl moment of like, When we saw Michelle Obama come out at that, you know, at the Trump inauguration with that hair.
You know what?
And every Black girl I know was like, oh, she done. Like, Michelle is over it, right? And, you know, and I watch white people read this now and they're like, that is fascinating. Like, we didn't get that. You weren't supposed to.
Okay. Exactly. We all knew what that meant. That shit was the shot heard around the world. Every Black girl said, ooh.
Yeah, we were like, oh, she is done. Word, you know.
We was just hoping she wasn't fit to swing on one of them. That's all.
Listen, somebody deserved it. For sure.
Well, speaking of swinging on people, because, you know, this whole week I've been wanting to swing on people. And it's not just the moon. It's actually the crazy shit going on in the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was on an airplane yesterday, which meant that I was watching the news continuously.
Yeah.
And it was a lot. I mean, it was all about the 1 year anniversary of the murder of George Floyd and how the country had had this racial reckoning. And then it would flip, right, to another story about, you know, a law that was just passed in Oklahoma that basically bans curriculum that makes people feel bad about their racial or ethnic heritage in the past, present, or future. I said, what the fuck is this? I'm like, so basically what you are trying to do is prevent having a real ass conversation about what's really going on in the world. Cause what you really meant to say was white people feeling bad about themselves. Like you got yourself fucked up. So I think the question here for me is what the fuck is going on with this assault on critical race studies? And why are we doing the most and doing the least at the same time? Are we in the midst of a culture war here? Why are these people going after our ability to even talk about race? And I know the reason, but I want to hear it from you because only you can put it the way you do.
No, I want to actually start on the day that the Derek Chauvin verdict came down. And so we as a nation, everybody's like, what is going to happen, right? And I thought in the days prior about how impeccable the prosecution's case had to be, how there could be no slippage and how, you know, all of us came to this current iteration of the movement, not because of Michael Brown, but because of Trayvon Martin. That was the night that, you know, when Zimmerman was acquitted was the night that y'all named Black Lives Matter. And so these show trials around race have been central to how our generation has thought about our country's ability to sort of take accountability. Mm-hmm. And so in many ways, even George Floyd was opening that wound that we all felt on July 13th, 2013, when Zimmerman walked away. And so we're all sort of in that. And before we can get the verdict, and just as it goes national, we get this story out of Columbus, Ohio, that Micaiah Bryant, a 16-year-old Black girl, has been shot 4 times center mass in front of the foster home where she is staying because of an altercation with some other young Black women. So shot and killed. And to me, that placed in stark relief the challenge that we're in, that on the one hand, we'll use our justice system for these symbolic sort of overtures that we get it right. And at the exact same moment as that's happening, we see how utterly, you know, ill-prepared the police are to actually service the day-to-day needs of the people. And we continue to see the seams busting open in terms of this system that we set up. But it also is this broader symbolic thing for me. We didn't get to the Chauvin verdict without Darnella Frazier, a Black girl who was taping it on a street corner. And I firmly believe that somewhere in the spiritual psyche of white America, the murder of Micaiah Bryant is this overwrought reaction to this sort of anger about the insurgency of Black girls, right?
That's right.
It's this anger about what you, Patrice, and Opal did. It's anger about what Stacey Abrams has done. It's anger about Kamala Harris being in the White House. You know, just like when Barack Obama came out in 2013 and said, Trayvon Martin, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon, right? And you looked at Trayvon and he looked eerily similar to Barack Obama. And so I think that there's this way that white people externalize their angst, their anger, their rage, their sense that the country is slipping away in these very spectacular murders of unsuspecting Black people. And then, much like the Colonial Project has always done, then it becomes a massive cultural gaslight, right? And I think that one of the reasons that we're struggling is because as Black people, we have been told that if we could just reason our way and engage in moral suasion and symbolic action and peaceful protest, that we could shift the terms of the country. And what we're seeing right now is white people walking away from an investment in the truth. They've never been particularly truthful, but now there's a brazen, open walking away, a refusal to acknowledge that white supremacy is actually a problem or that it is driving the heart of what the Republican Party has become. And there is an externalization of white anger against schooling, right? They're literally saying that the education system any attempt for it to have a fealty to actual American history, they are now calling that the lie, right? They are now calling the truth, whatever the truth is, the lie, and telling us that, you know, that it's something of, in the end, white feelings are, you know, one of the most lethal forces in the universe because they aren't rooted in truthfulness. And white feelings, I've said this in the things that I've written, white feelings are treated as facts, black facts are treated as feelings, right? And we're seeing that right now. We're seeing white people's mere impressions and fears become the basis for how they understand and structure politics. And we're seeing the actual factual circumstances of black life being dismissed as mere over hypersensitivity to racism and entitlement to things that we have not earned. And I think that we have to fight back, you know, as hard as we can to say, look, look, this is in the end why you need movements. It's not, I was going to say we have to fight back to say what the truth is. I think we have to do that. But I also think we have to recognize that at this point, it's actually about figuring out how to have power, because the battle over truth only matters if everyone values truth. But at the point that they say truth matters less to us than having power, then that puts black people in the position where the only thing we can do is actually, you know, retain and grab and, you know, figure out how to assert power.
You're a best-selling author, you're an educator, you're a professor, you are an expert in your many fields, you're a crunk feminist activist, and much, much more. I'm wondering if, in the spirit of kind of bringing our full selves, if you could offer some reflections on the movement moment that we're in now. What progress have we made, and where do we still have left to go? And just for context here, I'm emerging from a conversation with President Barack Obama. And I don't say that to name check the brother, although it is cool as shit to be. It's cool as shit. It's cool as shit. But that's not why I'm raising it. I'm raising it because we had the opportunity to reflect together. And I realized, as you know, in this very short conversation, that, you know, there's few of us who entered into this moment prior to 2020. And there's so many conversations right now that are being framed, right? Around, you know, this last year, a movement started.
Oh my God.
And I always say, okay, I have compassion for this because for a lot of people, movements begin where they enter. But the fact is that movements are long, and you and I have had the privilege and the pleasure, although it hasn't always been pleasurable, of seeing this moment, right? Not just this past year, but this last decade unfold and to be a part of shaping it. So that's a part of why I'm asking you. But I'm also bringing up the former president because this was a real pain point for me. You know, it's funny to be watching television now and to see on mainstream news people who were just last year like wringing their hands and clutching their pearls about defunding the police. I mean, everybody I've seen on the news is like, yeah, more money for police ain't the shit.
Come on. That's right.
And I'm so glad that we didn't capitulate to not saying defund the police when that's what people were telling us to do with Black Lives Matter. And Lord, you just got to say what you mean and say it with your chest. So I'm wondering, with all of that, if you can reflect on the last decade with us, because we did emerge under the presidency of the first Black person to ever lead this country. And there were a lot of contradictions in that internally to Black people. White folks were doing what white folks do.
Yeah.
But what I thought was really fascinating was the texture of how our communities responded to this moment. So maybe you could just give us like a retrospective. I mean, I know that's probably a whole damn book in and of itself, but.
That's right. Look, the thing I want to say to you for your heart is Black women will always be proven right in the end.
That's right.
And, you know, my mama would say, just wait on time, baby. Just wait on time, you know?
Just wait on time.
And that's hard because I see that in the conundrum of James Baldwin saying back in the 1980s, how much time do you need for your progress, though?
That's right.
Right. That white people, see, I'm saying that to you in my black mama speak. See, white people can't tell black people anymore, just wait on time, because that's a retrograde policy that's about maintaining their power. But when our that's mama right. say it, they're saying a thing about how we will have justice. It will be hard. It will not always feel sufficient, but just tell the truth. Just do your work. Vindication does have a way of showing up when you are on the right side of history. And so I would just say, be encouraged in that way. But look, I was annoyed and yelling at people in my own life last year, talking about 2020 and, you know, and we haven't seen this. This is new. And I was like, what do you mean? People have been in the streets for the better part of a decade. We came into the 2010s in 2011 with Slut Walk and Arab Spring, right? And so that's women were rising up all over the globe because a police officer in Toronto said that, you know, women should just stop dressing like sluts and then they wouldn't get raped. And so it isn't that police have been a friend to women of any race either. Our system of police doesn't help people based on gender. It doesn't help trans people. It doesn't help folks who are vulnerable to rape, right? So we had a national uprising that we didn't frame as being about the problem with policing, but that certainly was. And then we came into 2012 and Trayvon Martin was murdered and Jordan Davis was murdered. And we watched that Zimmerman show trial. And we understood that in many ways, this resurgence or this seeming resurgence of cop killings of black men was a direct response from white people to Barack Obama making it into the presidency, and that the country wasn't willing to tell that truth, because when he made it in, what we had been saying from 2009 forward was, oh, we're post-racial. And then we arrived at 2012 and 2013 and thought, what is this, right? And then we know about, you know, 2014, and it's not just Michael Brown, it's Eric Garner, it's John Crawford, all within the span of like 3 weeks in the summer of 2014. And so the organizing framework that BLM and BYP 100 had put together with all of that organizing in Ferguson, catalyzes into this massive and amazing movement. And when I saw folks, I was like, how do y'all think that defund police got operationalized so quickly? They didn't come up with that last May. I was like, Black Lives Matter put together an extensive policy platform over 90 pages. It's downloadable in PDF. It's got policy solutions. It's got models. And it has existed at this point for 5 years. And I make my students read it, right? Because I say to them, the reason that the folks in 2020 knew what to advocate for is because what happened when we came out swinging in 2014 is folks says, well, are y'all a movement or just a moment? And then very quickly people said, well, protest won't solve everything. What's your agenda? Policies do you want? And so BLM answered and gave policy platforms that then get operationalized in this moment. In the interim, Trump gets elected to the presidency very much as a response to BLM, not out of white working class anxiety, but because of white people's clear understanding that we were carrying the moral order of the day in the streets. And so we get a Trump presidency and everybody's scared, because now what you have is a fascist, and you don't know if he's just going to do to BLM what happened to the members of the Black Power movement, right? Lock them up, have a bunch of political prisoners, assassinate people like they did Fred Hampton. And so it took a little bit of recalibration. But the thing that bothers me is the inability of people to zoom out and to think about movements. It's like I tell people, my iconic thing is, in 1955, Emmett Till gets killed in August, and the Montgomery bus boycott happens in December. Now, the freedom rides don't happen until 61. That's 6 years, right? That's 6 years. Well, there's 6 years between Mike Brown getting killed in Ferguson and defund the police. How do we understand in the 1950s that the Montgomery bus boycott and the Freedom Rides are part of the same movement, and yet don't understand that this moment is also another iteration of the long Black freedom struggle, and that we've proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that it's not just a moment. It is fully a movement. And the way you know there's a movement is because you got the George Floyd Freedom and Policing Act. You got Minnesota talking about defund the police. You had BLM, you know, winning all of these progressive DA battles all over the country. You've got Rikers Island on the verge, you know, of being closed. There are signal victories that have come out of this moment of organizing. And the reason nobody want to give credit is because three Black women, two of them queer, led this revolution, brought us to this point. And I remember, and I teach your piece from the Feminist Wire in October 2014, when you gave a herstory of BLM, and you talked about the way that people take and borrow from queer Black women's work and don't cite it. And that has happened over and over again. Because what does it mean if the most visionary people in our country, our queer folk, our trans folk, right, our, you know, our queer and trans Black folk, our poor Black folk, are the people who are clear about what freedom means? And why aren't we listening to them? And so I am massively passionate about saying that my heart, despite my fear of the pandemic, was certainly in solidarity with all of the young people who rose up last year and came out all over the country. But I was like, you don't get to legitimize the part of the movement that you want. And the other reason that that happened, that they wouldn't legitimize 2014, is because what that would then be is an indictment. Because it would mean that if you had listened in 2014 when Eric Garner was lying on a street corner saying, "I can't breathe," we wouldn't have had to have a 2020, right? That's right. And in that way, liberal white people are as complicit in this whitewashing and this refusal of quote unquote critical race theory as absolutely everybody else. They only want to tell the story in the way that allows them to win. And that's why all white people got to have a reckoning, not just the conservatives, not just the racists, but also the liberals who don't want to tell the uncomfortable truths about how long they hung out watching all of this Black death occur and then decided one day that finally they had enough evidence to stand up and say no more.
And just like that, it's time for our weekly roundup of all the things Lady just ain't gonna do this week. Number one, full moon eclipse, Mercury in retrograde, and of all places, in Gemini. Well, my friends, it is certainly an intense time in astrology this week, as we have a whole bunch of whammies. The full moon eclipse happened this week, and a blood moon, which is all woo-woo speak for lots and lots of energy and emotions moving all around. And Mercury is about to go into retrograde May 29th and will last all the way to the summer solstice on June 22nd. Now, Lady knows she'd been talking about a hot girl summer, but I wasn't expecting it to be this hot. Mercury in retrograde is generally feared, but it really shouldn't be. Yes, it can be tricky with lapses in all your best made plans, but basically, it's a time to take your time. Don't make any agreements or don't sign any contracts. Look closely at the details and pay attention to communication of all types. My meditation for this Mercury in retrograde is to stay hydrated, mind my business, and clear my space for abundance. Oh yeah, and not to pop off on nobody, although literally in my mind this week alone, so many people can catch these hands. But in real life, just trying to keep it calm, cool, and collected, starting right after the rest of this roundup. Things Lady ain't gonna do this week, the real cancel culture trying to cancel critical race studies. So across the country, the party of no way, no how, no plans, no proposals has organized themselves, not to make sure that people are recovering from the pandemic that was partially people made, not to make sure that people have healthcare or jobs or housing, but instead to make sure that you no longer learn in school that race is a real thing that people made up to keep power in the hands of a few at the expense of the many. These motherfuckers are literally passing laws in state houses across the country that read like this one, especially fucking dumb, out of the great state of Oklahoma. It bans teaching lessons that would cause discomfort, guilt, anguish, or psychological distress because of a person's race or sex, and also bans universities from requiring trainings on race and gender diversity. Signed, y'all, by the governor, Kevin Stitt. File this, please, under white folks being fragile as fuck. Here's a thought. Instead of banning lessons about what this fucked up country has done to all of us, how about we learn from it by actually studying it so we can stop doing stupid shit, including passing laws like this? It's just apparent here that instead of dealing with real problems, lawmakers from the party of no plan, no proposals, no way, no how, create fake problems to distract you from the fact that they're not solving real ones. So much for that reckoning on race that everyone was talking about this week. Oh, and just to say it and have it be said, we should be uncomfortable. We should be guilty. We should be anguished, and we should have psychological distress from the shit this country has done. We absolutely should. But bigger than that, loves, Lady has been saying for a hot ass minute that we are in the midst of a culture war, where some folks want to take us all the way back to a time when people like me weren't considered to be more than 3/5 of a human being, passing more laws that encourage more mediocrity. And Lady most definitely do not like that. Other things Lady just ain't gonna do this week: crabs in a barrel mentalities, especially when one is trying to get justice. This is going to be an uncomfortable conversation for some, but I'm going to say it because I have to. This week's press conference with some of the family members of George Floyd, along with their legal team, especially attorney Ben Crump, it left a funky taste in Lady's mouth. There was a not-so-veiled swipe at Asian Americans in the form of, and I quote, "There have been other bills passed in the last 3 months protecting different groups of people. This group of people needs to be protected too. And this started a long time ago. There were some things that started a lot sooner and got protected a lot faster." This was a statement by attorney Justin Miller. And I call this onk logic. I'm sorry, but what a bunch of fucking bullshit. Embarrassing, if you ask me. Oppression Olympics is not a good look, sir. Ever. Way to make a press conference that was supposed to be about pushing Congress to pass a piece of legislation that frankly will not protect Black people, but that's another story. But way to make a press conference about passing a bill that could tinker with policing and data collection. Way to make it about your weird anti-Asian bullshit. I just get so tired, y'all. Nobody should get choked out by the police or shot up by white supremacists. It's actually not that fucking hard. And if you don't know how to put a period at the end of that sentence, sir, please don't step up to the mic and ruin it for the rest of us who have some good goddamn sense. Anywho, here's what we want more of this week. Number one, Lady loves slowly emerging back into the world. This week, Lady visited what used to be her home away from home, New York City, which you can hear in the background, which is slowly coming back to life. It's been a year, y'all, and some change since I've been in this city. And before this pandemic hit, people used to ask me why I didn't just get an apartment in New York City, because I was literally here at least twice a month for the better part of 2 or 3 years. Coming back here reminds me that we are never going back to the way things were. I'm never again going to be compelled to fly 4 hours for a 2-hour meeting because somebody can't figure out a remote option. But what Lady is loving this week is the reemergence. I can say that in my lifetime, I saw a city that never sleeps actually go to sleep a little earlier these days, but still, there is no place like this one. New York City, you still got my heart, and thank you for having me back again. I have missed you, and I will definitely be back, God willing. Other things Lady loves this week? Well, I think I love it. I don't know. I'm also sad. But this week, my sister, my friend, my homegirl, and hand grenade, Patrice Cullors, announced that she is stepping down from leadership of the Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation. Patrice and Opal and I started the Black Lives Matter Global Network in 2013, and I believe the foundation came along sometime in 2017. Opal and I have gone on to build our own projects, always fellow travelers and supporters of our sister Patrice. Sis, I'm so proud of you. I'm proud of you for all the ways in which you have stepped up for us, fearlessly and courageously and doggedly. I'm proud of you for how much grace you have, even when people didn't earn that grace and didn't give it back to you. I'm proud of you for everything that you've built. I'm proud of you for all the ways in which you give to us all. And I'm especially proud that you've decided to follow your heart and dive into what makes your heart sing, making the community that raised you better and stronger. I love you so, so much, Sugar, and I cannot wait to see what these next 10 years have to offer. Congratulations, and I'm proud to be your sister. Tell the people who are listening right now where they can connect with you on the socials. And before you do, let me just tell you, we had Dream Hampton on the show a couple months back, and she was like, I don't want y'all to hit me on the socials, just to keep it a buck. So only share what you want to share.
That sounds like the Dream Hampton that I know and love.
It is definitely true. You know it is.
No, come through. I'm at Professor Crunk on Twitter and Instagram. And also, please, please, please subscribe to the Crunk Feminist Newsletter, theremix.substack.com.
Oh, I'm so excited. Thank you so much for being on today. You're the best. That's it for Lady Don't Take No, but I'll be back here every single Friday morning to accompany you where there's a chance you might be commuting again. We appreciate you joining us, and let's keep the conversation going. Tell us what's on your mind, tell us what you like, and tell us what you ain't gonna take no more of. On Twitter, we're at Lady Take. On Insta, we're at Lady Don't Take No Pod. We're also on Facebook at Lady Don't Take No Podcast by Alicia Garza. We post ways to do something about the things you hear about on this show all over our social media. So if we got you amped up today, check out the socials to find out how you can take action. And let's give a special shout out to Jahari Farrar for making sure that people get what they need from the socials. We appreciate you. Please subscribe and write us a review and let the people know what you've heard here today. Our producer is Phil Circus. Our incredible theme is by Latyrix. And this pod is supported by the Black Futures Lab. And I'm your host, Alicia Garza. Remember, full moons, eclipses, and Mercury in retrograde means sit your ass down and work on yourself. The culture wars are raging, and we would be smart to stop that shit dead in its tracks if we hope to keep pushing this movement forward. And the thing that's wrong with the crabs in a barrel mentality is that the barrel was never the crab's natural habitat to begin with. That's right, I said it, because Lady Don't Take No.
Lady don't take no shit, insist on respect the sister, walk around like a woman is. She won't speak unless it's something worth saying, don't play. The girl take herself so seriously, people stare curiously. She got a natural way, her hips sway furiously, get luxurious.
Love y'all. Like the